The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold.
Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery.
This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org.
Thanks for listening.
This is from the Transmission of the Light, Case 21, the 21st Indian ancestor, Jayata. Kumarata said to Jayata, "Although you believe in three kinds of karma, you don't yet understand that karma comes from confusion. Confusion is based on perceptions. Perceptions depend on delusion, and delusion depends on the mind. The mind is originally pure, having no origination or destruction. In it, there's no fabrication, no retribution, no victory or defeat. It is serene and spiritual. If you penetrate this teaching, you can be the same as the Buddhas. All good and evil, contrived and uncontrived, are like dreams or illusions." Jayata understood the message and realized knowledge of the past. Kazon's verse. "The camphor tree, as ever, grows to the sky. The branches and leaves, roots and trunk, flourish beyond the clouds." Good afternoon, those of you at home. So as you know, we're studying karma, this ango, which simply means we're bringing it out so that we can see it more clearly. As practitioners, in essence, we are always studying karma. We are always in the midst of it, seeing it arise, seeing its consequence, feeling its weight. And as practitioners, more and more using it skillfully, adeptly, to our better purpose. This collection of koans is kind of unique. It's part of the Soto tradition, having been put together by Kazon, who was several generations after Dogen. And it is said to each case is the enlightenment experience of the ancestors, beginning with the Buddha and ending with Ajo, Dogen's successor. Master Dogen wrote one of his fascicles, Karma in the Three Periods, where he focuses on this story. And in that, he says, "Venerable Kumarata, the 19th ancestor," so the numbering is a little different, "journeyed to central India where he met a seeker called Jayata." I guess he's not including the Buddha, is my guess, whereas in the Transmission of Light, the Buddha is number one. So I think that's a discrepancy. So Kumarata journeyed to central India where he met a seeker called Jayata, who asked him, "My parents follow the path of the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but they've been sick and nothing goes well for them. Our next door neighbors have been engaged in the low practice of slaughtering animals. They're butchers. Yet they're healthy and content. Why is it that they are happy while we are so unfortunate?" How does the human world work? People have wanted to know, probably forever. I don't know if it's always been true, but it seems like there is a universal sense that good actions should bring good results, that if we live in a certain way in our lives, kind, courteous, respectful, conscientious, responsible, and so on, then the results of those actions of living that way should manifest. But how do we understand it when they don't? And how do we look at it in terms of our own individual actions as a human being, between ourselves, person to person? In other words, individual meaning how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to each other, how groups relate to each other, clans, tribes, countries. And going beyond human actions, how are we to understand all of the things that happen in the world that are not human caused? Floods, fires, famines, droughts, earthquakes. It seems like it's easy to appreciate how easy it would be to think that when some things happen, there is a reason. And that if it's a good thing, we are being rewarded, and if it's a bad thing, we are being punished. When there's a breach in the fabric of the universe, is it our relationship with the universe? Is it our relationship with the forces of the universe? Is it our relationship with the creator of the universe? With some other unseen forces? It's often presented as a test of faith. Think of Job in the Old Testament. That was a mighty test of faith. It's often seen as a trial, a kind of trial within spiritual practice. But often to think of it that way means there is some force, some consciousness, some intention that is exerting itself, playing itself out, or directing itself towards us. Buddhism doesn't see it that way. The Buddha didn't see it that way because, quite simply, he saw no evidence for that to be so. He did see other evidence that pointed in another direction, which is the teaching of karma. Within the understanding of rebirth, traditionally, that we have lived countless lives because there is no beginning to the universe, and this is where you have to stretch your mind very wide. It's hard for the human mind to hold infinity, right? How do you hold that? But in Buddhism, because consciousness depends in this moment on the previous moment of consciousness, because all things are dependent, everything is compounded, nothing just appears on its own. That's why one way of looking at or understanding that everything is empty of any intrinsic self-existing quality, attribute, force. And so with consciousness, then there can be no time when consciousness didn't exist, and then suddenly, boop, there it is. Because then it would be autonomous, it would be self-existing. It would bring itself into existence. It's the quest in the Christo-Judaic world is what existed before God? Well, there is no before God, right? Because it's the same problem. And different. With different results. But within the teaching of rebirth, we have lived, each of us have lived countless lives, an infinity of lives, in all different forms, which means we have died countless deaths. We have suffered in countless ways. And we've also acted in all manner of good and bad. From the perspective of rebirth, we have done really, really bad things in past lives, and we have done really, really good things. In other words, we have lived the whole spectrum of human life within the many lives. And that the karma of all of those lives is carried on through consciousness. Not as a person, not as you, but as a propensity, as seeds, as inclinations, as a force. And so when we see actions that bring consequences, that's confirming of our sense of how things should work, but we don't always see the consequences. When we see negative actions seeming to bring good results, we see people acting badly and seeming to live good lives. From a Buddhist perspective, it may be that they are living the advantages in this life of past lives. I mean, that's part of the whole system of the realms of existence, is when you get to be, to the God realm, it's all good. But you're living off of the fat of before, and you have forgotten. And in forgetting, we don't keep that going, and so we eventually fall because we've gotten lazy in our good life. So are those positive action, the positive lives that we see in the present, a result of their negative actions? If you're living good lives, having good life in this life, is that a result of their negative actions, which is how we tend to see it, because we see the negative action, and at the same time we see them living a good life, and that doesn't seem to be the way it should be, right? In our basic sense that things, there should be some cause and effect that makes sense to us, which is kind of interesting. Why do we think that should be so? Is it because we have a sort of built-in sense of morality, a sense of fairness and justice? How do we understand this? And so in the Fascicle of Dogen's teaching, he says, he quotes Kumarata, who says, why to Jayata, he says, why should you doubt? Why should you have doubt about this? The results from our wholesome and unwholesome actions take effect in the three periods, the three times. You see this often spoken of this way in the teachings. But people only see that the peaceful die young and the violent live long lives, or that the unrighteous prosper and the righteous decline. Therefore they deny the law of cause and effect, of karma, and say that our negative deeds and our good deeds have no consequence. Doesn't matter, right? In other words, that's a conclusion that we can take from surveying the landscape and seeing those things. We can say, okay, well, evidently there is no causal effect, therefore it doesn't matter what I do. But he says, they don't know that the shadows and echoes follow our actions without a hair's breadth gap. The results of our actions don't get worn away, even in 100, 1,000, or 10,000 eons. And hearing these words, Jayata was freed from his doubt. As this is presented as a koan, it says, Jayata understood the message and realized knowledge of his past, of the past. And so while karma, the action, is not deterministic, as in one action determines the consequence, as though there can only be one result, one consequence, because that would be deterministic, it is taught that every intentional action does have consequence. And that can be very subtle, very minor, very light, very insignificant. It can be very profound. And that every action, when it comes into our experience as a perception, creates what the Yogacara school speaks of as a seed, something that sits within our deepest consciousness. And so the Buddha said, when something happens and we become frightened or we become angry, it's because the seeds of those particular emotions are already present within our consciousness. It can't just arise otherwise. So when we get angry in one moment, and from that perspective, we can know that we have gotten angry before many times. But that imprint, that seed, has no location. It has no existence. It's not a thing. It has no inherent quality. And in that aspect, in that emptiness, it manifests, it carries through our consciousness, and then is reborn in each lifetime. But it is also true, looking at it in, through the same lens, it is reborn in every moment. Because what we perceive or think of as a continuity, a continuation of the self, you or me, that exists from moment to moment, the Buddha realized that does not exist as we think it does. That is empty. That self is empty of self, of continuity. And so in that way, rebirth is happening in every moment. Consciousness is continuing in every moment, dependent upon the past consciousness, carrying all the seeds of our karma, setting up or creating a kind of proclivity or inclination for how we experience things, perceive, think, talk, act, react in this moment. So when we really begin looking at this, you know, if we sort of began Buddhist practice with all of this and really looked at it, at a certain point, we would think, oh my God, I have to do meditation. Wouldn't we? Don't you think? How else are we going to examine, get to understand that that very consciousness and those, all of those karmic influences? There's a sutra, a very interesting sutra called the Dog Duty Ascetic Sutta. And in it, there are two ascetics, a dog duty ascetic and an ox duty ascetic, which means this is an ascetic practice in ancient India. Dog duty ascetic is somebody who lives like a dog, literally. They eat scraps, they sleep on the ground, they scratch behind their ears, they probably bark. They try to embody completely a dog, and an ox duty ascetic would do the same as an ox. So these two ascetics go to the Buddha, and the first one, who's the ox duty ascetic, Punya, says to the Buddha, "Venerable sir, this naked dog," so they've gone to the Buddha, they've approached him with the proper respect, offered their greetings, and then the dog duty ascetic in the sutta says, curled up in a, like a dog, right next to the Buddha. Just the visual. right? So Punya says, "Venerable sir, this naked dog duty ascetic, Senia, does what is hard to do. He eats his food when it's thrown on the ground, sleeps outside, he gets kicked by people. He lives the life of a dog." He says, "This dog duty has long been taken up and practiced by him. What will be his destination? What's his future course? What is this going to bring him? Right? What's the fruit of this very, very difficult life?" Like, I mean, this person, he's not playing around. I mean, think about that. It would be an extremely difficult ascetic life. And the Buddha says, "Enough, Punya. Don't let that be. Don't ask me that." And Punya asks again. And the Buddha says again, "Enough. Let that be. Do not ask me this question." And then he asks again. And then the Buddha says, "Well, Punya, since I certainly cannot persuade you when I say enough, let that be, don't ask me that, I shall therefore answer you." And then he says, "Here, Punya, someone who develops the dog duty fully and unstintingly, who develops the dog habit fully and unstintingly, develops the dog mind fully, develops dog behavior fully, having done that on the dissolution of their body after death, he will reappear in the company of dogs. But if his view is such as this, by this virtue of, or duty or asceticism or religious life, I shall become a great god or a lesser god." In other words, if he thinks, "I'm going to be reborn in a really much, much better circumstance because of this ascetic practice," the Buddha says, "That is wrong. There are two possible destinations for someone with such a wrong view. He will either end up in hell or he'll be reborn as an animal. So if his dog duty is perfected, it will lead him to the company of dogs or else he'll be reborn in hell. And when this was said, Senia, the dog duty ascetic, began bursting into tears and was crying. And the Buddha said, Punya, I couldn't persuade you when I said, enough, let that be, don't ask me that. And Senia said, Venerable Sir, I'm not weeping that the Blessed One has spoken thus. I'm not weeping just because of what you said, but rather this dog duty has long been taken up and practiced by me. I've been practicing this a long time. And of course, the teaching that the Buddha's pointing to here is about the nature of karma. And that it's not just enough to be dedicated to be to practice fully and unstintingly, but we actually have to be skillful. We have to be applying that great effort, that heroic effort, in the right way. In a path that is actually worthy of that kind of dedication. It's also just interesting to think about all of the different ways, particularly at a time like that, maybe differently, but in some ways similarly now, today, that people try to live their life, and people who are very, very determined might go about a spiritual practice trying to make sense of their world, trying to liberate themselves. And that question, but is it a true path? Will it lead to what one sincerely and justly, and since righteously, is seeking? And so here the Buddha says, one produces a karmic bodily process when we act with our bodies that is bound up with affliction. When we create such an action, or a verbal process that is bound up with affliction, with greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy. Or a mental process. He said, by doing so, we will reappear in a world with affliction. And when that happens, afflicting contacts will touch us. In other words, we will encounter, we will have experiences, sensations. Through our senses, we will come into contact with different things that will bring forth affliction within us. Remember, those seeds are present within our consciousness. They're already there. They're, in a sense, primed. Because we have been practicing and repeating over and over again, they're sitting right there on the surface. And again, this is all just a metaphor for how to think about how our consciousness works. And he says, being touched by these, we will feel afflicting feelings deeply. Sometimes as though we are in hell. Thus, I say, beings are heirs of their karma. We inherit. And so we can all see how when our mind is filled with a certain state, it inclines us into that state. Inwardly and towards the world, to experience that in the world in a similar way. When the mind is imbued with loving kindness, patience, generosity. You know, think about a child. Somebody just recently wrote me a note because I did a mando last weekend with the New Zealand Sangha on karma, and somebody wrote a note about a baby, an infant, and said, do they appear in the world like a blank slate? And I thought I could hear parenthetically, I hope, I hope, I hope. Please say yes. And I said, well, but they're awfully sweet. But from a Buddhist perspective, they're not entirely a blank slate. I remember my mother once saying, I don't know whether it was in delight or an exasperation. I can't quite remember the context. But she said, I have three siblings. She said, you each came out differently. I can remember it that way. I can remember, you each came out so differently. And what she was saying was like already kind of made. Cooked. How do we understand that? And the Buddha's teaching traditionally is that, as the Buddha says, a being's appearance in this moment is owing to the karma they have performed. And so that if I experience the world within afflictions, or being afflicted by the world in this life, it's because of my afflicted karma in the past, which has all kinds of implications and overtones, some of which are very difficult, right? That if a person is living in this life in a body or in a situation or in an economy or in a country or in a faith in which they are subject individually or as a group to hatred or violence or oppression, that somehow that is the result of past karma, that's a very, very difficult idea to want to, for me personally, to hold on to. But the thing that we can know for sure, and I think it was a little easier to understand, is that whatever our experience, a person's experience in this world, whether it is just or unjust, whether it is fair or unfair, how we respond to it is the one thing, in a sense, we have some control over. The more bound we are within those afflictions, the less control we have. That's what happens. Our mind like narrows down, sort of collapses down into a tunnel. And oftentimes, how many times have you been in a situation where things were at a very heightened state and something happened and you just reacted, and when you look back, could you really say, yeah, I had choices there. I could have done this, or I could have done something very differently. Oftentimes, that's not true. We don't see those choices. Of course, objectively speaking, from a more absolute perspective, we could say, of course there are choices, but not from the perspective of the person who's inside of it. That is our reaction, and that's why the world blows up. And people blow up. And we don't have to. And so Dogen says, this is how the investigation of Buddha Dharma should be conducted. Don't join those with crooked views who don't know that the truth of law of a cause and effect, and do not clarify the results of their actions. Ignore their relationships between past, present, and future. And don't make a distinction between what is wholesome and unwholesome. In other words, don't align yourself with those or with that view that is just ignoring all of that or coming to erroneous conclusions. Dogen says what Kumarata meant by the results from our wholesome and unwholesome actions is that they take effect in three periods. This is a traditional teaching. One is we experience the result or the consequence in this lifetime. The next is that we experience the result in the next lifetime. And the third is that we experience the result in some future lifetime. So in essence, we don't know. We will not be conscious of that result, except from a Buddhist perspective, in the moment when it's happening now, if we really have faith in this, we know that the ground for this was laid before, some before. But again, whether we really believe in that or not, you know, and my suggestion with these teachings that are sometimes difficult to embrace or just to know for sure that that's true because it's not in our experience, is to just hold them in an open hand. When the Buddha was enlightened, he himself said on the night of his enlightenment, when his mind was concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, free of defilement, pliant, malleable, steady, imperturbable, he directed it to the knowledge of recalling his past lives. So he actually recounts these three different stages of his enlightenment on that fateful evening, and that he directed, because his mind was in such a state. And again, this may be hard for us to really appreciate, identify with, that he directed his mind to recollecting his past lives. And then he goes on to say how he saw past lives, 10, 50, 100, 100,000 eons of cosmic contraction and expansion, which is how in Buddhist cosmology the universe it comes into being, it endures, it goes up in flames, it collapses, and then it is regenerated over and over again. But in that vision, he saw that in this life he had such a name, he belonged to this clan, he looked like this, this is what he ate. It's quite detailed. And then passing from that life, he saw how he was reborn in the next life. And then he goes on to say that in the same state of mind, during the second watch of the night, he saw by means of his enlightened mind, beings passing away and reappearing in accordance with their karma. So he saw into, so the first is he saw into all of the ways in which we are reborn over and over again. And the second, he saw more specifically the nature of the karma, the actions, the lives lived, and how that bore out. And Dogen said, these are called this lifetime, the next lifetime, and some future lifetime are called the three periods. And in this, we study and clarify the principle of the effects of karma in the three periods. If we don't, he says, many of us will make a mistake and fall into crooked views. Not only do we fall into erroneous views, we get into unwholesome realms, we experience suffering, we don't maintain wholesome roots, we lose a great deal of merit, and become obstructive. Would this not be regrettable? And to think about how this teaching is used as in Buddhism, as practitioners. So how often do we, I mean, it happens in so many ways. It's like, I remember, you know, if you've ever learned a musical instrument, right? Particularly an instrument that's difficult, the violin. When I was first studying the violin, when I was living in New York, I was living with my girlfriend. When I would go over to pick up the case, she'd say, I'm going out, see you. Like clockwork. She'd go for a walk, she'd go to the corner pub, she would absent herself. Because it didn't sound so good, right? As I was just learning to play the violin. And so, if we demanded immediate results, we would never learn a musical instrument, right? We wouldn't persevere knowing that if I keep doing this, has the potential to become extraordinary or satisfying. Or when we're engaging in large projects, very large projects, if we think about wanting immediate results or fixing this problem, we're not going to get very far at all. If we came into Buddhist practice and say, yes, I'm all on board with this. What do I do? Sit down and do zazen after about 15 minutes, like, are you kidding? This isn't working. Right? I'm doing it, but it's not working. And so we know, we have learned in all kinds of ways that we have to sustain an effort with the hope. We do generally expect results in this lifetime. And sooner, generally. But to think about how that teaching of, if not now, in other words, you may experience the consequence of an action, you may not. But what the teaching says, what Dogen says, what the Buddha said, is that it is not possible for there to be an action without consequence. So it will bear fruit. And so then to think about the power of that in terms of giving us faith and conviction and strength to do what may be difficult to do, like living a moral life, being a bodhisattva, practicing selflessness, working with our anger. Letting go of judgment. Forgiving someone when it's difficult to forgive. How that teaching can give us faith and a sense that there is, that this makes sense, right? That there is a reason. But even without that, if we understand that in this moment, how I combust, as Dada Roshi used to say, how I bring myself forward, the mind of this moment, is my world. And so in a sense, irrespective of what happens next, the mind that we cultivate, the action, the words that we express, the practice that we engage, is now. So he says, although you believe in the three kinds of karma, you don't yet understand that confusion, the karma comes from confusion. And the confusion is based on consciousness or perceptions. Karma arises from illusion, seeing things as alone, apart, self-existence. And so there's that metaphor of the actor, right? And Kyabgon Trelag says the whole notion of self-transformation, that myself at this moment needs a little bit of work. I'm going to improve it. I'm going to transform it. I'm going to enlighten it. And then I will have an enlightened self transformed from my delusion. He says this proves to be untenable. It's not real. It would be a superficial change, analogous to an actor's changing costumes, which tends to be often how we think. For the Buddha, in rejecting this, was saying that the actor and the costume are the same. One is what one is acting. However we act it out, we project ourselves. That is what we are. But he doesn't mean that's what you are in any fixed sense. He just means that's how you appear in that moment. That's the mind that you're creating. That's the experience that we're having, and that's what we're giving to others. The performer of actions is not an agent disassociated from their actions. Changing costumes, identities, roles, personas, while the self remains fixed. So what does it mean then to be authentic, to be genuine? In the midst of different relationships, different roles. It's one of the things that happens in training all the time. By design is that we move in and out of different roles. So in one moment we're taking instruction, we're the student, we're learning. Next moment you're supervising, you're overseeing, you're giving instruction. In one moment, we may have some responsibility, some position of responsibility or power. In the next moment, others have that. To be fluid, to move in and out, to not reify, to not take on. Illusions are based on perceptions, not seeing things as they are. I mean, think about how many times, you know, we may have looked at someone or looked at a situation and immediately come to an assessment. This is who they are. This is what's going on. And then we find out it's entirely different. It's entirely different. How many times do we not find that out? But it's true. I remember when I was waiting tables for many, many years, how many times I learned that. Because waiting tables, at least when I was doing it, there was sort of a thing about, you know, we can just sort of, you can sort of get, that's how you know you're a pro, right? You can look at a table, they're going to leave me a good tip, they're not going to leave me, they're going to be difficult, they're going to be easy. And so many, and sometimes, you know, it kind of worked out that way, but sometimes people would surprise me in the most surprising ways, which was delicious. And that delusion depends on the mind. Delusion, our non-awakening, our yet to be fully awakened, is mind. And so that's why Kumarata says the mind is pure. It has no origination or destruction. There's no fabrication. No retribution, no victory or defeat. It is by nature serene and spiritual. Peaceful, awake. Bodhidharma said Buddha means miraculously aware. And that awareness is awareness. It's not awakened awareness, it's the awareness we awaken to. It's awareness that's always there. And so we should not and cannot practice in such a way to make this mind pure or to make this self-enlightened or to even purify what appears as impure or obstructive. When we see things that way, that's our karma. So when we're sitting and things arise one after the next and we react this way and this way and this way and this way, that's our karma. That's the way our mind has been conditioned, trained, made habitual. It's not the thing itself. And that's really what we're trying to create space in order to see. When I talked about reactivity this morning, that's the reactivity is what's important. That's where we're creating more binding karma. That's where we're releasing it. We get often too hung up in the object. We don't ignore it. We see what's there. We recognize it. We make contact with it. We make intimate contact with it. But while those afflictions are calming, we need to really be paying attention to how we respond to it. The mind is originally pure. And so that is something we have to take on some measure of faith, right? Because it does not appear to us that way. But having faith in that does allow us to practice in accord with that, which is a very different kind of practice than when we assume that the mind is like a trash can, right? Where you have happened to accidentally throw in some good stuff, so you don't want to throw that out. But as you're going through it, you find a lot of stuff that we might think of as garbage. And what do we do with garbage? Well, we throw it away. Incinerate it. Letting go is not throwing away. Letting go is releasing our grasp. Letting go is releasing our grasp of that idea that there is something inherently wrong in this thought, even if it's a rather vile, mean-spirited, petty, even if it is something you don't really want to strengthen, you don't want to follow that down its path. And that's just skillful means. But its nature itself is not intrinsically evil. It is the nature of mind, peaceful, serene. The camphor tree as ever grows to the sky. Not sure why he chose to speak of a camphor tree as a kind of evergreen. It's used for many things. It's used as medicine, maybe, a medicine tree. The medicine of the Dharma. Its branches and leaves, roots and trunk, flourish beyond the clouds and flourish on the ground and underground and all the way through. There is such a tree. You are like this. I am like this. And so as we are in this session, practicing as we are studying karma, and gaining more understanding, to really be bringing that understanding to bear in terms of what are you experiencing in your mind. The Buddha said it's not really possible to practice to awakening without a clear understanding of karma. We have to understand how this human world works. And that's not just for enlightening our wisdom, but it's also for our compassion. We need to understand how we work and how people work. How else can we be skillful? How else can we love them? You, ourselves. Because if we don't understand the inner workings, then we tend to get caught up in the outer workings. And sometimes those are hard to love. And so it is an inner revolution Robert Thurman said, we are inner astronauts.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.